This is the Plant on the Line program here at thecommentary.ca. Linda McQuaig is the author of 7 Canadian bestsellers and winner of a National Newspaper Award. She has written for the Globe and Mail, Maclean's, and the Toronto Star. Her latest book is Holding the Bully's Coat, Canada and the U.S. Empire, $34.95 from Doubleday. Linda McQuaig spoke with me from here in Vancouver.
Please welcome to the Plant on the Line program, Linda McQuaig. Good morning, Ms. McQuaig.
Morning, Joseph. Nice to be here.
Thanks for joining us. This is an interesting book because a lot of what's happening currently in Ottawa, federal politics and so on, plays into to what you're writing about. You write a lot about Afghanistan and our role there. But I'm interested in your thesis that Harper is Bush's key ally in the world today after Tony Blair. This may seem like a simple question, but how do you see that as?
Well, okay, I see that as the fact that, you know, Blair has for years been, of course, Bush's key ally, and he's about to resign. And, you know, there's not that many world leaders left that are, you know, actively supporting Bush. I mean, there are, of course, allies of the, you know, technical allies of America, but they're, a lot of them are quite restrained in their enthusiasm, whereas Harper is really quite a active supporter of Bush and his war on terror. And I think that, once Blair has resigned or has retired, really Harper becomes the most important world leader that is still actively supporting Bush.
But we have no troops in Iraq. Iraq seems
no,
to be...
That's true. That's true, but the war in Afghanistan is another front in the war on terror, and we're playing a very active role in Afghanistan. I mean, we are playing a leading role in the most difficult part of the war. We're obviously taking a very high level of casualties. We're also playing a very active role in kind of castigating the other members of NATO for not stepping up to the plate enough in Afghanistan. This is extremely useful to Bush because it allows someone other than himself to kind of be in the forefront of, you know, berating the other nations in NATO for not playing a strong enough role there.
If we believe the Prime Minister at his word when he says that that a number of Canadians support the United States, support Bush's efforts in Afghanistan and Iraq. I mean, he said that in the press. You write that in your book that he does. He has said that in the Wall Street Journal and so on, in an editorial or op-ed. Do you think that that is valid, that Canadians, perhaps, that a portion of Canadians support the United States in their efforts, do you think?
Sorry, are you talking about Afghanistan or Iraq?
Well, you write in the book that after the Chrétien government had not voted for the
had decided not to join the coalition.
Correct.
Willing, so
that Mr. Harper and Mr. Day.
Oh yes, yes.
Had written an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal saying that that was not reflective of all Canadians and that
That's
they respected they represented the other way.
Right.
Do you think that that's a valid point that perhaps some Canadians believe?
Well,
in
I mean, certainly there were. I mean, going back to 2003 when that decision was made. I mean, there was some controversy over it when Chrétien decided to not send troops to Iraq. There were some outspoken voices, as I mentioned, you know, led by Harper and Day, for that matter. And I seem to remember Mike Harris and Preston Manning and people like that were also enthusiastic about going to war with the U.S. And you know, there were some ordinary Canadians as well. But I would say overall And going back and looking at the polls, too, there was strong support for the Chrétien government's decision. And certainly, as time has gone on, Canadians have become, I think, overwhelmingly pleased that we didn't join the U.S. in Iraq. But my point in making that in the book is to remind, to kind of remind the public that, you know, Harper, from the beginning, was very, you know, a strong supporter in Bush and Bush's, what I consider, and what a lot of people consider, a kind of a lawless approach to the world. in the war on terror. And this is not something new. This is, you know, if Harper had been in power back in 2003, I don't think there's any question at all that we would have been there in Iraq.
What do you think it says as an observer of Canadian politics, as an observer of the country, about Canadian values, that perhaps the mainstream of Canadian people, not obviously subscribing to the Prime Minister's ideals, don't support the United States in Iraq or in Afghanistan?
Well, I mean, I think it does speak to Canadian values, but let's even, you know, before we even get there, let's remember that, you know, I think it's, you know, only 28% of the American public even at this point supports Bush in Iraq. And, you know, around the world, I mean, the Pew Center in the U.S. has done polling from around the world over the last few years to show just how incredibly unpopular Bush and his administration and certainly his, you know, war on terror is in virtually every corner of the globe. So you don't even have to be Canadian or have Canadian values, you know, whatever those may be, to have an extreme level of discomfort with a lot of what Bush does in the world. But if you want to talk about, let's say, Canadian values, I don't know. I tend to define Canadian values as things like equality, inclusiveness, respect for the rule of law, you know, a dislike of imperialism, if you want. And I think that you know, these kinds of values are not reflected in the kind of aggressive approach that Bush has adopted, really, you know, throughout the world. I mean, but most notably in Iraq and Afghanistan. I mean, both of those wars certainly began as illegal invasions without the authorization of the United Nations. And you know, I think Canadians have always been strong believers in, you know, internationalism, international law, respect for the rule of law, all these sorts of things. And you know, it just is in violation of international law to support illegal invasion. So I think just by, you know, by, I don't know, by nature or by our inclinations, Canadians are not supportive of these kinds of preemptive ventures.
You criticize the Conservative government. Do you take much stock in what the Liberal Party says? How do you view their record
their record is bad in many areas as well. What I'm kind of focused on in this book is what I see as a kind of fundamental transformation that's happened in Canada in the last particularly in the last 4 or 5 years, in terms of our going from being a nation focused on peacekeeping, internationalism, the United Nations, you know, that kind of approach to the world, and being a nation that's much more oriented around the military, essentially a junior partner in the war on terror. I think that's a significant transformation that we've seen. And I think it began particularly under Paul Martin. I mean, this is something that's been sort of in the works since 9/11. But it was particularly got a boost under Paul Martin. I mean, Paul Martin significantly pushed up military spending, for instance, and started to change some of our approaches to the Middle East, became a little bit more pro-Israel as opposed to being more, attempting to be sort of more even-handed in the Middle East. And it was Paul Martin also that changed our mission in Afghanistan from the sort of UN peacekeeping mission around Kabul to the more aggressive fighting of fighting insurgents in the south of Afghanistan. It was Martin that was responsible for that change. So, you know, the Liberals are by no means off the hook here. But things have accelerated under Harper. Harper has been an even more enthusiastic supporter of this transformation, of this moving ourselves more closely in line with the Bush administration. Another example of this, of course, is what we've been seeing recently in Ottawa over the past 2 weeks with the all the furor over the detainee abuse abuse and torture in Afghanistan. And that was a policy that was put in place by the Liberals in December 2005 and, you know, kept in place by the Conservatives. And, you know, I mean, it was clear, it was absolutely clear that we were handing prisoners, these detainees that we seized in Afghanistan, over to the Afghan government, even though we knew that the Afghan government practiced torture. You know, this was detailed by the Afghan Independent Human Rights Commission, by the U.S. State Department. It was well known that the Afghan government practiced torture. And in fact, the Canadian government had reports from their own officials stating this. And yet nothing was done about this until it became kind of exploded as an issue in the media and from the opposition. So, you know, I mean, that to me is a clear example of how compromised Canada has become as, you know, complicit in torture. I think this is completely out of sync with the values of ordinary Canadians.
Do you see much hope, though, that if the government should fall and the Liberals were to come back to power, that the direction that we're taking in our foreign policy would change?
Now, that's an interesting question. I don't know what the answer is because, Dion is a whole new character. I would like to believe that there might be some change. On the other hand, it's really hard to know. I imagine Dion is a little bit more meticulous about observing international law in terms of, let's say, handling detainees in Afghanistan or something. But I don't know overall that there would be a switch back, that we would cut back on military spending, that sort of thing. I really doubt that we would. I would like to believe that we would, but, I think these things should be major issues in the next election campaign.
Do people ask you ever if you're anti-American?
They don't ask me. They accuse me of being anti-American generally. And my response is that I am not anti-American. I would call myself anti-American exceptionalism. And by that I mean I'm against the notion that the United States is, should be regarded as some kind of special power, some kind of special country, some sort of beacon of freedom in the world that is therefore entitled to operate differently in the world, operate by its own set of rules. And this is, in fact, I think, the attitude of a lot of our high-profile commentators that, that even though we wouldn't tolerate it if, let's say, the Soviets had invaded Iraq, for some reason they think it's okay for the United States to invade Iraq because they just assume that, there must be some benign purpose to this invasion, even though, many people can see quite easily that certainly oil was one of the motives of the U.S. invasion. So I'm just saying I'm against the notion that the U.S. should be treated as some kind of special power in the world. To me, the United States is a country like every other country in the world. It operates in the world to advance its own self-interest, and it often does so quite aggressively. And so, the United States is entitled to the same rights as every other country, but I don't think they're entitled to any extra rights. And, in the minds of a lot of people, that makes me anti-American. I think it just makes me a follower of international law.
You talk in the book about how we should pay attention to the messages we get in the media, in particular messages that we get from prominent commentators that we often see in the national news and in op-ed pages and newspapers, people like Margaret Wente and Rex Murphy you take on. You also take on Robert Fulford and David Berkusen. What is it about their role in the media that we should be wary of?
Well, I simply pointed out, and I used some, actual examples of things that various people had said to show that, that they had this attitude, they have this attitude, and it's often kind of not, you know, perhaps not that clear, but that if you actually analyze what they write, you know, they are American exceptionalists. They give this, you know, they have this notion that America can operate by a special set of rules in the world. They never come out and say that, of course, but they say it by implication in their willingness to tolerate, you know, what behavior that would not be acceptable if other countries did it. And I want to identify that. The other thing that they do is that a lot of them have a tendency to really kind of, you know, well, first of all, if Canadians attack America, attack the Bush administration for what it does in the world, they're quick to brand us anti-American, and I think that their dismissal, their attempt to shut down debate like that, should be identified, because I think Canadians should feel free to come out and express their criticism of America. The other thing that this group of commentators, what I call this sort of neoconservative group of commentators, do is that they, you know, they get upset or they put down Canadians when Canadians do nothing more than praise Canada. Point to a number of examples where, you know, if you sort of point to things you like about Canada, a set of values, a set of, you know, let's say our commitment to peacekeeping or internationalism or our attempt to make this a more egalitarian country or whatever, you know, they'll kind of slap you down for that. I mean, they don't like any notion even of, you know, that we might have some sense of identity as Canadians. So this has led me to the conclusion that, in fact, the real problem afoot in the country may not be anti-Americanism so much as anti-Canadianism, you know, anti-Canadianism on the part of some key high-profile members of our media elite.
Do you think, though, that mainstream Canadians, people on the street, people that aren't part of, you know, who aren't part of the media elite, do you think that they actually believe or take the same opinion that a prominent columnist would take?
You know, that's a really interesting question, because, of course, everybody, you know, has the potential to kind of filter these views out and think the way they want to think about things. But I also think it's true that, you know, to a certain extent, the media is kind of just a chatter going on in the background of our lives. I mean, people are busy. They don't have time to sort of sit down and assess the sort of hidden assumptions and a lot of the things that commentators say. They just hear a debate. They'll flick on TV and they'll hear commentators talking. And, you know, without sort of going to the trouble of analyzing all the assumptions that they're making, they just get a sense of sort of what the thinking is on various issues. And because these sort of neoconservative commentators are given so much space, so much airtime, they tend to just sort of dominate the available media time. And so I think a lot of ordinary people just kind of absorb a lot of this thinking without sort of having necessarily an opportunity to kind of filter it through and thinking, well, now just a second, does that fit with what I think? And I think what the effect of this is that it gives the public a kind of sense of how people think about things, like how these issues should be thought about. Whereas, in fact, the positions that this group of commentators takes are really just one point of view. And you know, I would argue not even the right point of view on a lot of issues, not even not even a correct point of view, not often misleading, often quite out of sync with what ordinary people aspire to. But it tends to be the voice that sort of dominates the public debate.
Linda, do you think the people that you take on, Rex Murphy and so on, what's their reaction been to your accusations in this book?
Joseph, to tell you the truth, I haven't asked them, and they have. Oh, I did actually get an email from David Berkeson, just sort of, just kind of making a joke, saying that any attack from me basically could do nothing but help him. So, you know, for what that's worth.
Did you find, though, that the framing of this debate in our media, that it's too polarizing, that both sides perhaps are amplified, that we don't get the real message?
Well, I, I mean, I guess I would see the problem as somewhat different. I think the real problem is that there aren't really two sides, particularly to this debate. We essentially only hear one side. Perhaps that's overstating things. We do hear bits and pieces of the other side, but the voices that dominate are so loud and clear. Let me just give you one example. On the National, for instance, there's that regular panel that they turn to for sort of commentary on the news.
The Ad Issue panel.
Yeah. And as far as I can see, whenever I happen to catch that panel, there's always Andrew Coyne, who's a hard right-wing conservative type. Then there's Chantal Hebert, who is actually kind of non-ideological, who's just basically interested in observing, who's winning and what's happening in Quebec. She doesn't take an ideological stance. And then, I don't know, typically what I see it, the third person is usually somebody from the West, some conservative from the West. So it typically seems to be two strong conservative voices and a person who's, really treats politics as just kind of a horse race to figure out who's winning and who's losing. So you don't actually get an articulated point of view from the other side. I've never seen that on that panel. Well, I find that bizarre. I mean, here we are, in just about any issue that they would be discussing on that, we get kind of two conservatives and one person who kind of doesn't have a point of view left or right. Well, that's not a debate. Do you remember on CBC Radio, years ago, the Peter Zofsky show, they used to have a regular feature, Kieran's Camp and Lewis. And,
right.
It was an excellent debate they always had. It was, Stephen Lewis, Dalton Camp,
Eric Kearns.
Eric Kearns, yeah. And so you'd get kind of real viewpoints, real debate, different points of view. That's what I yearn for. I'm just saying, let's have a debate. Let's get these issues properly debated. I want to hear from the right, but I also want to hear from the left. I want to hear from the middle. What we hear increasingly is just essentially from the right, with occasionally a smatter from, smattering of something from somewhere else. I mean, or if you check on the internet, you can find these voices in the alternative media. But in the mainstream media, it's increasingly, I find at least, dominated by the neoconservative right.
So you think we shouldn't hold the bully's coat out of the United States? How then do we frame the relationship with the United States? It seems to me that conservative and liberal governments have always felt that a healthy working relationship with the United States should be the main priority of the government of the day.
Well, a healthy working relationship with the United States would be a terrific thing to have. I think that'd be great. That's very different than holding the bully's coat. I mean, I would like to have a productive relationship with the United States where we speak honestly and openly about things. But, I mean, let's go back to the way things were, let's say, during the war in Vietnam. That was another era where the U.S. was behaving very belligerently in the world. Canada didn't get involved in that war. In fact, Lester Pearson, even, in his famous remarks at Temple University, actually criticized aspects of that war. Right, in the United States. I mean, it's inconceivable to imagine Stephen Harper doing something like that. And I'm not even saying that he would have to do something like that, but I'm just suggesting that we have a foreign policy that's based on our own needs and our own beliefs and our own ideas of how we should operate in the world. Let's put it this way. I think it's absolutely clear that we would not be in Afghanistan, we would not be fighting insurgents in Afghanistan if it wasn't that the United States, pressured us to get over there and fight their war. And that we did it, to please them, to curry favor with them. We don't have any vested interest in Afghanistan. We don't even particularly have any historical interest in Afghanistan. I mean, it's just bizarre that we're over there. And clearly, you know, you can say we're, you know, the motive is to help reconstruct Afghanistan or help the women of Afghanistan. But this is just not what's going on over there. I mean, you know, 95% of what we're doing over there is fighting insurgents. And furthermore, if we wanted to reconstruct countries or help women in the third world, you know, we wouldn't necessarily go to Afghanistan. I mean, we are in Afghanistan because we are trying to curry favor with the United States. And I don't think that's a sound basis for a foreign policy.
This is obviously a timely book, and you seem to strike a chord with a lot of Canadians throughout the country. What's the reaction been to the book as you travel the country on this tour?
Well, you know, I find very positive response generally. You know, I will admit when I do phone-in shows, I have in Alberta, for instance, I did get some very hostile reactions. You know, they mostly to the notion of calling the U.S. a bully, like they just absolutely resented that. So you know, there have been some hostile reactions, but I would have to say overwhelmingly, I'm always struck, in fact, that when I, you know, do media across the country, most of the media people I find generally agree with me. Like most of the people that are at least doing the interviews, and these are different than the sort of high-profile commentators that I'm referring to that I think have, you know, have such a role in shaping the debate. But at the level of, you know, people that are interviewing me in their, you know, phone-in shows or whatever, I find them generally quite sympathetic to the arguments in the book.
What are you working on now?
I'm working on this. I mean, I find that, you know, when you do a book, there's the process of researching it, there's the process of writing it, and then there's the process of taking the book to the public. And you know, they're quite different. Like, you spend, you know, so much time in the researching and writing of it, and you sort of think, well, geez, you know that subject inside out. But when you actually go to talk about it publicly, you have to kind of, you know, rejig the whole way you think about it and figure out how to communicate it orally. So I don't know. This is certainly my preoccupation right now.
Finally, I wanted to ask, you have been attacked by Conrad Black in the past. Have you been following his trial?
Well, certainly it's hard not to follow his trial. I mean, it's so fascinating, for one thing.
Is there any glee, do you think, in his troubles?
Any glee?
On your part, perhaps?
No. I can't say there's any glee. I mean, I'm certainly fascinated to see what happens to him. You know, I wish him no ill will, and you know, beyond perhaps thinking that it would be good to see him horsewhipped, but you know, nothing more serious than that.
Well, Linda, thanks so much for joining us today, and congratulations on this book, and continued good luck with it.
Okay, thanks a lot, Joseph.